Hello and welcome to episode 63 of the Desi Outsiders podcast. I'm Meenal.
And I'm Ankita.
And this Navratri, we bring you internet's favorite guju, Parle Patel from Planet Parle. His real name is actually Pranay Patel, for those of you wondering. We discuss his life as a British Asian, where he spent 6 years of his life in Australia and has his family roots in Kenya and Gujarat. And Parle tells us about how proud he is to be a blend of all these cultures today.
Parle also talks to us about his experience with mental health, his journey from the time he was a child and his parents forced a camera in his face asking him to make home documentaries, and how he started his own YouTube channel later on. So today, Parle hosts his own radio show on the BBC Asian Network and is a pivotal force in reviving the Gujarati culture amongst British Asians.
And we hope you enjoy this episode as much as we did recording and speaking to Parle. So without further ado, let's jump right into the show. Welcome to the show, Parle. I've been following you for almost 5 years now, and it's safe to say that you were with me throughout my medical school journey. And I still remember doing some exams and the night before just watching your videos to cheer myself up. So thank you so much for joining us today. We're so happy to have you on the
show. Thank you so much for having me. How's it going?
It's going great so far. I'm freezing because I'm sitting in my closet and I have my heating off because the heating is in my closet. So I've told the story so many times on this podcast. I just had to mention it once again, Parle.
Oh, God.
You just open the camera.
Please, I want to know. I hate being cold. And so I would love to hear some stories about heating.
So basically, I'm wearing two hoodies, really thick socks and gloves right now, if you want to know.
Okay. I am wearing like a mishmash of clothing because I'm going out to Garba later on this evening. Mm-hmm. So I am wearing a kirdyu, which is like a traditional men's like Garba attire. I'm wearing tracksuit bottoms and I was wearing Crocs, okay? To be very honest with you.
But you had to get rid of the Crocs so that you could come on the interview with us.
Absolutely. I went back indoors and I switched to something far trendier, okay? So we're good to go now.
Well, I'm pretty comfortable in my tracksuit and my cup of chai.
I have a coffee as well.
We people in the UK are just freezing our butts off with this mini beast from the east. So no one asked you sitting there in Prague.
Do you know what? I do not even know where and why it is still snowing. Like, how? Yeah. Like, you know what? The cherry blossoms were out. So I'm like, okay, it's all finished now. Like, that was fun. Got some photos. And it came back. And I'm like, this isn't so, like, unnecessary right now. It's still snowing right now. I'm watching from my studio window and it's still snowing.
Yeah, it is.
But you guys have only had this for like a week or maybe not even a week. You know, I've been here for 5 years and we have to go through this for like 3-4 months continuously.
Mina, so we don't mind if this starts in November and lasts till, I don't know, Jan end. But exactly. We don't like it when it's in the middle of March.
Yeah, exactly.
It's the typical British. You've turned like a Gordy, Ankita. Now you're complaining about the weather like the British people. Just shut up and get on with it.
That's all we can talk about in this country most of the time.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. If you want to try and talk about anything else, it gets too dark, too political, too serious. So let's just stick to the weather. It's just easier.
Nobody cries. Nobody cries. Everyone is happy.
Exactly. So Parle, speaking of British, are you a second or third generation British citizen?
So I was born here. My mum and dad were born in East Africa, in Kenya. Wow. And one of their parents from both sides was born in Africa as well. So I've got really weird sort of heritage. We're like British East African Gujaratis. And to confuse you all even more, I lived in Australia for 6 years of my life as well. So I moved to Australia when I was about 7 and then came back to the UK when I was 14. So you can imagine how crazy it was when I lived in Australia trying to explain to people that, hey, I'm Indian, but I was born in the UK, but my parents are actually African. So they would be like, oh my, just so confused.
A bit of an identity crisis.
Well, it wasn't even a crisis. I saw it as something to, you know, really celebrate and embrace. And I think that was so important that I did that then and I still do that now. Because right now in the media, especially in the South Asian media, everything seems to be about being a victim and I'm South Asian, so my life has been far worse. And there's this horrible sort of tinge where everyone's sort of, not everyone, but a lot of people as and a lot of public figures sort of feel so, like, not negative, but gloomy about having Asian heritage. And while they celebrate it with a sort of like, well, I'm a victim type thing. Now, obviously, I don't mean to say that you can't decide if you're a victim or not, but I feel like my personal story is that I never felt like a victim, really. Like, obviously, being brown, living in Australia and Britain, it was my identity was obviously often questioned. But I feel like that's made me who I am today. So it's not been like negative or dark. It's been something I very much love. Like, I wouldn't switch being British with being an Indian Gujarati, or I wouldn't, you know, say that actually I wish my mom and dad were Indian Gujarati. I absolutely love that I have like Kenyan heritage. I love that the Gujarati we speak has so many Swahili words as well. So when we go out to India, people are like, huh, what are you talking about? And I'm like, well, yeah, we've got a touch of Swahili in our Gujarati as well. So yeah.
So Polly, what were you doing in Australia, and why did you...
Yeah, we moved there as a family. So my dad was the very unconventional Mr. Patel. He never owned a corner shop. and he...
Did he work in a pharmacy?
No. He was a telecommunications engineer. So he basically used to oversee the digitization of the analog telephone switches around the world. So he used to travel far and wide for work. You know, he's traveled to Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, Japan, the Philippines, France, Germany, Sweden, like in countless places. And he got Australia as like a project. And it was a sort of like a weird one for him, because obviously Australia was so far. But the company that he was working for said that, why don't you move out there with your family? So he was like, well, why not? Let's go on this adventure. I mean, you know, we have no family in Australia as well. So it was a proper adventure where we knew literally nobody. Maybe apart from like one or two people that sort of you turn into family because they're like related to someone that you're related to. So, yeah, it was kind of like that.
Yeah, every Indian person you probably came across in Australia became your aunt and uncle.
Yeah, you know what? They did. And sometimes I feel like they were more hospitable, loyal and loving than my own family over here. So like, it was a crazy one. And it really taught you to value people for people rather than, you know, family for family and that sort of thing. But it was an incredible experience, as I said, a lot of identity clashes and that sort of stuff. But yeah, I really wouldn't change it for the world. It shaped me.
But Polly, what's the Gujarati culture like there? Obviously, we know, we'll get into this later, but we know it in the UK, there's a big Gujarati culture that you're very involved in. And what is it like in Australia?
So in Australia, when I was out there, it was still like a budding community, you could say, with maybe I was in Melbourne, and Melbourne had about, I would say, just over 2,000 Gujarati families. So it was very tight-knit. Everyone knew everyone. And compared to the UK, like, there wasn't like multiple organizations or communities kind of like representing Gujarati culture or like Gujarati community. There was just one, the Gujarati Association of Victoria. I have heard, however, like 2,000 has turned into like 20,000 now. It was very different for my family because we, as I said, we were East African Gujarati, whereas in Australia a lot of people were either directly from Gujarat or Mumbai or South Africa, we found. So it was very interesting for us.
You know, you mentioned earlier how you meet people who are more like family than actual family, and how you had this, you know, connection with so many people when you first went to Australia, and also because you spent most of your adult life and childhood outside of India. I wanted to ask you if you've ever felt or experienced that the Desis abroad sometimes, on the flip side, can be more mean to each other than even the locals in those foreign countries, or more racist even.
Oh, 100%. 100%. I'm always talking about this as well. Like, okay, so I'm wearing a kedu right now, as I said, because it's Chaitra Navratri, first day of Chaitra Navratri today. So I'm seeing some friends this evening for some garba, which obviously I'm always looking forward to. But if I was to wear this on public transport, I would receive more abuse from other South Asians than white people or black people. Like, the white people here would actually be intrigued and interested in what I'm wearing. And usually black people always compliment me for what I'm wearing and are always interested in, you know, what the garment is. And they're really, like, polite towards it. Whereas this is themselves kind of like frown and laugh and sneer. And it's so weird. It's kind of like, well, you're probably the same people that complain about, you know, racism in society, but
you're doing it yourself.
Yeah, you keep that racism so within the community. You're part of the problem. Because if you can't champion your own culture, then you can't expect other people to.
Yeah, and because partly I live in Edinburgh where we don't have a lot of Indians. Like, mm-hmm. when you walk out on the street, you don't see a lot of Indians, that at least in comparison to London, I'm saying.
Yeah, of course.
That's how it is. But a lot of blogs that I read, because I only visit London sometimes. I don't live there. But in,
well,
in
make
a lot
sure you let me know when you're down next time.
Yeah. No, I mean, I was just reading recently how a lot of Indians talk about how they see another brown person on the street and they don't really even make eye contact because they're like, I'm not you. I'm not one of you.
Mm. Do you mean as in, do you mean they see from, as in someone from India rather than British born?
No, not just, I mean they see, South Asian basically.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Not India, but... So the blog I read was that of an Indian person, but she...
Okay, but you mean generally South Asians, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So you see someone who looks like you and you immediately don't even want to make eye contact or get in touch with this person because you just want to show everyone, you know, I'm not like you.
It's funny. That's I'm the complete opposite. Like every time... I mean, even in Czech Republic, there are not many Indian people. But when I do see someone who looks like they're from a South Asian community, I get really excited and I smile at them.
That's what it was like in Australia
a lot of the time.
That's what it was like when I lived in Australia. So if you see someone Indian or South Asian, whether, you know, whether they're Pakistani or Sri Lankan, anyone who appears from your South Asian subcontinent, they literally will be invited around for dinner. You won't even know their name and they'll be in your house like drinking tea. I remember once we had like a door-to-door saleswoman and she was, I can't remember what she was selling, but it turns out that she was Indian and my mum invited her in and she made her tea and she loved my mum's tea so much. And my mum makes chai masala or chai masala at home. And next thing I knew, my mom was literally packing her chai masala to take home. I'm like, Mom, you don't even know her name. But that there was that kind of excitement when you would see another brown person. Here in the UK, yeah, it's not the same. Because I think that there's like this stigma around typical brown people here in the UK. So typical South Asian behavior that often people don't like associating with. So that's why they like to differentiate themselves, maybe.
And Paulie, one thing that everyone just loves about you is how proud you are of your roots and how you both speak and speak Gujarati really well. You depict the Gujarati culture in your videos. But you once said in an interview, and I quote, "Our Gujarati culture is under attack, not from outsiders, but from within our own people."
100%.
So as an NRI, you know, why exactly do you feel that way?
Because we have never, as Gujaratis, understood what it means to really let our culture grow in a truly dynamic way. In a way that means we're not recycling, in a way that means we're not limiting it to, let's just say, like the nine nights of Navratri, or in a way where we are saying that actually culture isn't owned by anyone. It's not like... this is culture and this is how it should be. But actually culture is very fluid. It moves around. It evolves. It has a few base principles. Yet that's always changing and evolving as we go on in time. And I feel this because Gujaratis in general will champion Indian culture before they champion Gujarati culture. And the people that do champion Gujarati culture sort of get, not pushed aside, but sort of get pocketed into this like small group of people that are either very rural or they're very sort of right-winged, hardcore sort of like orthodox Gujaratis who believe that, you know, music should only sound a certain way or mm-hmm. art should only look in a particular way and theater that goes on should only be about this subject. And because of that conservativeness, it's kind of meant that if you're Gujarati and you want to get into your culture and you want to do something new, you have to then let go of being Gujarati and kind of like become one with being Indian, because under the Indian title, you're far more likely to be accepted to be doing something, you know, new or different or unconventional. Does that make sense? Like,
yep.
For example, like Gujarati music. Gujarati music is hugely popular during Navratri. However, you won't see that much new Gujarati music coming out during Navratri. I mean, in the last 5 years, there's been like this awesome revolution in the Gujarati music industry, in the Gujarati arts industry, where more and more people are sort of feeling like, actually, this is my culture. I'm born into it. I'm allowed to do what I want with it. And so that's changing. But for a long time, every Navratri, you would hear the same songs. The dance styles, you'd see the same styles. And there was like this stagnant sort of feel in terms of culture. However, that's really begun to change. And I feel like it's been that way purely because Gujaratis themselves haven't said to themselves that actually my culture is more than just nine nights of the year, or if I want to be Gujarati every day, I can. And being Gujarati doesn't necessarily mean I'm a vegetarian and I love Garba. It can mean a whole bunch of things, if you know what I mean. So,
yeah,
it's really interesting, Parley, because I come from a Punjabi uh-huh. family, and I've never actually thought about it in this way, in the sense that,
well, you let know, me in terms give you
actually bringing.
Just before you continue, you mentioned mm-hmm. that you're Punjabi. Let me give you a wonderful example. If you go to a Punjabi wedding, you will hear nothing but Punjabi music. Is that true or not? 100%. Yeah, of course, if it's yeah. a Punjabi wedding, thematically, musically, everything will be Punjabi. You go to a Gujarati wedding and you yeah. will hear every single mm-hmm. genre of music. You will
exactly,
hear Bollywood.
That's exactly what
you
I was
will
going
hear
to
Bhangra,
say.
You will hear yeah. Garba. You will hear R&B. That is Gujarati identity. Yeah. To go anywhere in the world and embrace the local mm-hmm. culture to the point where you negotiate with or sacrifice your own culture. And while that's a wonderful attribute to have as a community, to be able to blend in with another community or to latch onto another community but still call yourself Gujarati, it's also dangerous as well, because as generations move on, then the culture begins to fade faster. And that's what kind of really inspired me to do what I'm doing with Gujarati culture, whether it's through comedy or through music. And that's also like really important to me. Whilst I do so much fun stuff surrounding Gujarati people and like our behavior, creating music, choreographing dance, working on, you know, much more serious type stuff is equally as important to me, because I can't be the person that's pointing a finger at my community but not taking action and then like creating a revolution, if that makes sense. And this is really deep rooted, by the way. Even if you look at Gujarati politicians, they will start off in Gujarat and then they will quickly move on to India, whether it was Gandhi, whether it's Narendra Modi now, whether it was Sardar Vallabhbhai Patel, whether it was Amul Dairy, which is India's biggest you know, dairy provider. It's a very common theme with being Gujarati. You start locally and then you expand nationally. But yeah, there's a big sacrifice that's happened along with that.
Because even with Punjabi culture, there's always the latest Punjabi mm-hmm. songs, latest Punjabi mm-hmm. music. And as you said correctly, you go to a wedding and you hear just mm-hmm. Punjabi music. And this is exactly the point that I was going to make. When you go to a Gujarati wedding, you don't hear a lot of Gujarati music or like trending music. But is there, I know you work quite a lot in this field of music as well. But apart from you, are there other people also?
Yeah. creating and
music,
I mean,
and
creating far bigger stuff compared to like what I'm creating. Like, I suppose my music it's very British Gujarati, so I will kind of like have a you know, like a baseline meeting Gujarati folk vocals. But out in Gujarat, you're seeing this incredible revolution that's led by young people, which is so exciting, where they are adding elements of Bollywood production value to Gujarati songs. And we are now seeing Sunidhi Chauhan, Shreya Ghoshal, Arman Malik, Arijit Singh all sing in Gujarati for regional cinema. And these videos are racking up views in the million. And this next generation of Gujaratis, more importantly, are doing this not because they have to, but they want to do it. They want to reinvent what it means to, you know, sing in Gujarati, or what it means to release a Gujarati song. So that revolution is happening, but we've kind of lost like a whole generation of content. I mean, looking at it very sort of broadly, like, you must understand that in the South Asian subcontinent, Hindi has about 400 million speakers, Punjabi has more than 120 million speakers, but Gujarati around the world has less than 50 million speakers. So that's one thing that a lot of people forget. And also, vernacularly, like the language, Gujarati is very different from Hindi. Whereas Punjabi has so many overlaps with Hindi, it can be used interchangeably and mixed to a good extent and still be understood by a mass audience. And because of that, it's easier commercially. It's more viable to release music that has a Punjabi flow or a Punjabi twang, even though it's Hindi. Mm. That makes sense, because it will still reach the masses and the masses will still able to connect to it. Whereas Gujarati is not exactly like that. It's completely different as a language, so it makes it more difficult to reach.
Yeah, is it just along the same lines of speaking about our generation? You mentioned that now there's we sort of missed a generation, but now people are actually trying to pick up Gujarati music and actually trying to celebrate the culture. But it's when I remember when I was in Gibraltar, and I was raised in Gibraltar, Pale. It's a small country near Spain.
Yeah, of course,
you know
what
that
is.
not many people know.
It's a UK territory, isn't it, around Spain? Yeah,
it is. Yeah. So I still remember when I was younger, my mom made it a big point that in our family that my brother and I learned Hindi not only with our speaking, but we also know how to read and write. And my mom really made sure that we learned this really well. And I still remember our neighbors and my mom's friends used to point fingers at her and be like, why are they learning Hindi? They don't need to. They're in Europe. And it's now that when I go back home, like 20 years later, a lot of the aunties now, they're like, oh, wow, Meenal, you speak Hindi. That's
amazing.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
You know, now they're actually, like, there's a massive shift in their thinking.
Yeah.
And there's also a massive shift in our generation itself as well, where we want to exhibit more of our culture and we want to embrace
it.
Like, you know, we have people like you, we have Superwoman, Just Rain, and so many other booming YouTubers in the scene. So there's obviously been a massive shift, and it seems to have happened within this last 20 years. Like, I've seen it with my own eyes from a young child to now. So why do you think that's happened, and what are your thoughts on this?
People are quickly realizing that to run away from your roots is a really dangerous thing. To not accept who you are can be extremely dangerous, because then what you're doing is you're leaving it up to someone else to learn about your roots and your culture. And as soon as you do that, there's always the danger of them teaching you about your culture incorrectly. So, for example, if I didn't know about the story of partition, about, you know, the history of India, then if someone was to come up to me and try and educate me and say the wrong things, I would have to accept them, because I would know no different. I would have to, you know, honor what they're saying, because I don't know any different. So if they were to say that, okay, India is a country of peasants, and, you know, Bollywood is just singing and dancing, and Indian music all sounds the same, but I didn't know about the truth behind this, then I would have to very much accept it. So it's becoming educated out of responsibility that kind of gets you passionate about it. And what you said about language is so important, because knowing another language, doesn't matter how big or small it is, it unlocks another world of literature, of arts, of culture, of news as well. There's so many news stories that are only broadcasted in Hindi or only readable in Hindi. So then it kind of, to know another language, it's a big deal. And I think people are beginning to realize this through like social media and the rest of that.
You know, I just realized a very complex thing as a South Indian, based on what you said, Meenal, what you said and what Parley said, which is that A, learning Hindi is important, and B, there are some stations that only broadcast in Hindi, etc.
Yeah.
So when I was growing up as a South Indian in Mumbai, when I was really young, there was another neighbor that we had who was also a South Indian who grew up in Mumbai. So she knew Hindi, but she would go back to her South Indian roots and she would speak to the people around her, or at least she would speak to her family in front of other
Absolutely.
People in Hindi. And that was a big status symbol sort of thing. So that... Does that make sense?
For people
in the South, for a really long time, to know Hindi and to speak in Hindi was a big deal.
Of course.
And they were kind of shunning their own roots at that point. That, oh, I don't know how to speak my mother tongue, but I know how to speak Hindi. Ooh, and hence I'm much more like advanced.
Well, this is the same in India when people speak English and they think they're more intelligent because they're speaking English. And it's like, well, intelligence is about subject, not about in what language you're communicating, whatever it is you're communicating. I think that's scary, that whole subject.
Yeah, and while we're on the subject of languages, Parley, I want to ask you, it is so difficult to be funny in different languages. It's easy to be funny in your mother tongue. It's easy to be funny in a language you spoke growing up.
Yeah.
But you're funny in both English and Gujarati.
Many people
in the world, you know, and I mean this genuinely, because there are so many people in the online world that do what you do, which is to portray their cultural nuances in a comedic manner. But it's very difficult to make people laugh with almost every video that you put out there.
Oh my God. You
still manage to do that. So what's your secret behind that?
You're embarrassing me, but I'm smiling. That's such a nice compliment. Thank you. Do you know what it is? Authenticity and... By authenticity, I mean that there's a lot of these YouTubers, and I don't mean to say this in like a hateful way, or I'm not like being negative towards them, like, oh, this is why it's not working. But like, there's a lot of YouTubers out there that will want to make videos where they want to, you know, take the mic or sort of make a comedy sketch about their culture. So they'll get into a character and then they'll make some sort of sketch. But if you actually look at what they're doing, they're not wholeheartedly becoming another character. They're probably, I don't know, just whacking a wig on or a dupatta on, and then all of a sudden they're a mum. And then when they're themselves, they're themselves. But watching, you can't really tell like a solid difference that, oh, character A is now character B. And I think with what I've done on my channel is really, really, really tried to study the way a typical British Gujarati mother speaks, her mannerisms, what she enjoys, what she believes in, what political party she votes for, where she goes shopping, everything, to like really become a character. Change my voice, everything. As much as I possibly can for an internet sketch, I've tried to do that. And that was the dream, to like change myself, to become something that I'm not, to portray what it is that I'm trying to say, if that makes sense. So I wasn't perfect at Gujarati. When people are like, oh my God, you speak good Gujarati. And I'm like, well, thank you, but it takes a lot of practice. So I have to practice Gujarati all the time as well. I have to write dialogues down and practice my tone. Ask my mum that, you know, if I was to say this, what word would I use? Would it be this word or this word? And what would my imitation be over here? So it's taken a lot of thought, I'll say that. And it's also a passion. I'm so passionate about language and dialect and anthropology, just people in general. So it's made me quite, I don't know, like passionate to try and deliver that authentic type content rather than me just putting like a scarf on or whatever and being like, okay, I'm a mum now. Type thing.
But you said that your dad was not the typical Patel, and you said you did all of your research on what a typical Gujarati mom would be like. What is your family actually like, and where did you do this research? How did you get all
it wasn't things? Even based completely on my parents, but it's kind of like if my parents were to take some sort of drug and become like a crazy sort of character, and that would be what you see my YouTube parents. And I've just been observant from day one, in all honesty. Like, I've always watched people, and not in a judgmental way, not to be like, oh my God, you're bad for doing what you are. But it was kind of like, you're so different to who I am. And rather than me hating that person, like, oh my God, I really don't like this person, I was kind of like, oh my gosh, we are so different. And that's what it turned into. And this is why, as crazy as all of my characters are on YouTube, I love each and every one of them. I don't have like, oh, I hate Gujarati mothers, or I hate brown people in the UK. It's kind of like, I'm pointing a finger at them, sure, but I'm pointing one at myself as well. And that's where like the whole self-depreciation type of humor comes from, that nobody's perfect and we should all celebrate the best and worst bits of who we are. But a lot of observing. And when I was young, my mum used to always make me do theatre. Like, go, get on the stage, do dance, do theatre. And my dad was so embarrassing. He would always, like, give me a headset and connect it to his video camera. He's like, come on, let's make a documentary. And I'm like, no, dad, let's not. And he'd be like, come on, quickly, we're in Mumbai, talk about Mumbai. And he would literally be filming me, like, outside the slums and be like, pretend you're a news reporter. And I'm like, oh, my God, this is too much. So I kind of feel like they pushed me into it. Yeah, they pushed me into it. When people, like, when they were like, oh, like, where does all this even come from? I'm like, you two. I was like, Dad, you used to always tell me to watch people. Like, we would be out and, like, an uncle would be talking and my dad would be like, look how he thinks he knows everything, but he clearly doesn't. He goes, just look how he's standing. Because look at the glasses he's wearing. So I'm like, Dad, you made me observant. And my mum, I'm like, you're the one who used to dance and do theatre and write scripts and love the arts and public speaking and, you know, community type stuff. And then you've always encouraged me to do the same as well. So I'm like, it comes from you two. It's a very like right hand, left hand thing. Pretty crazy.
Because Ankita and I are big fans of Khichdi,
oh,
TV shows.
I don't know if you watched like, it.
Brawful. Yeah, of course, like, of course.
Yeah,
Brawful. Yeah. Like, we just feel like in every Gujarati family, every aunt is like Kokila Ban, every uncle is like a Brawful. So when actually yesterday we were talking about Khichdi, we spent like half an hour just laughing about it. And we wonder if Parle's family is like that.
We do. We have all those characters and more in my family.
You know, my mum and I used to do the Khichdi thing with Hansa saying, hello, how are, khana khake jana? And there was this bit where they introduced Praful's brother and everyone would say, Praful ka bhai bloody fool?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so...
Yeah, I was going to say, like, the thing is, like, these jokes sound so lame. Like, I mean, people are probably thinking, like, our standard is so low in terms of comedy. But the thing is, the reason why it's funny is because there's a truth in it. Like, we know that most Gujaratis' family have a Praful or a Kokila Ben, and that's why it's funny. And I think this is why we love your work, because we know there's a truth in what you do. And whether it's an exaggeration or not, that's what really makes us laugh.
Well, if anyone, I often get these aunties that will be like, oh, you know, it's very exaggerated what you do, it's unrealistic. So I just ask them that, like, what do you do at 8:30 on a Tuesday night? And they're like, well, we finish cooking and we're in the sitting room relaxing. And I'm like, okay, and whilst you're relaxing, what are you watching? And they're like, well, we usually watch our soaps. And I'm like, are you talking about those soaps where they look like they're going to a wedding every single day, that even if they're on their deathbed, they're wearing about £5,000 worth of gold, They're artificially whitened to the point that they look like Arabs. They have dyed hair and the latest designer sari, but they represent a middle-class family in India. And then they're like, yeah, but I'm like, yeah, but what? I was like, if they're allowed, I'm allowed, isn't it? If they can exaggerate and you take that in and that's the benchmark of excellence, then my form of storytelling should be allowed the way this. I should be allowed the same right, isn't it? And then they just shut up and leave me alone and just say "jibri bol ambiche," meaning like he's got a really big tongue. And I'm like, yeah, I know.
No, like, literally, my mom kicks me out of the room whenever I point these things out to her. I say, why is she sleeping in all that gold? Or why does she
I
have
just
that
watch
makeup
it. It's comedy.
On right now?
So I just watch it with my mom. And my mom's always like trying to explain the storyline to me. And I'm like, mom, literally, if I was not your son, I would not be sitting here honoring this conversation. But I'm here just out of duty. So you don't need to explain everything to me. But she always tries to explain the storyline and whatever. And I'm like, I can't take it.
And the thing is, like, we always know the storyline is going to be so boring and so terrible. But our mothers make it sound as if it's really dramatic and really theatrical and, like, really amazing. But they all have the same story.
Well, what's sad is, in all honesty, some of the storylines have been a catch to me personally. But the style of storytelling is just too intense for me. Mm-hmm. I'm like a lover of, you know, art cinema and like, you know, very subtle storytelling where drama's created through like good acting and sort of like a naturalistic sort of thing with like a touch of abstract in terms of how the camera's working and whatever. So it's like a very artsy sort of feel. So when I watch these, I'm like, this is just too much. There's too much color. There's too much lighting, there's too much effects, too much music. I'm like, I can't concentrate because there's just too much going on. But I think what you just said, like about Khichdi and whatever, I think one of the best things about being Gujarati is our ability to laugh at ourselves and not get offended. And this has really helped me. Like, honestly, like being on the internet, like making comedy videos about Gujaratis and having 99% of the people laugh along and just spray the comments with like the laughing crying emoji and just being so happy and going, oh my god, this is exactly what we're like. It's such an honor. There's no like hate campaigns towards me, like Parley's, you know, doing this and that and it's really bad and whatever. And I have friends from other South Asian communities and they get so much hatred for doing what they're doing. And even though there's so much truth behind it, but they still get like, you know, 30% of their comments are hate filled and there's so much negativity. And I'm like, I'm so blessed to be Gujarati that my people just laugh and just go, yeah, this is exactly what we're like. And that I think that that's been the best bit for me personally, that as funny as we are, we're accepting and we're not gonna kind of be offended and whatever. And we also understand that there are times where you need to be offended, but you must save that for like more important things. Like, I don't know, the mistreatment of women in the Asian South continent or corruption in the government in the Asian South subcontinent. That's what needs our outrage. That's what needs for us to be offended, not my videos where I'm making just making funny videos on the internet. Do you know what I mean? So channeling outrage into the right things. So I think that's one of the best things about being Gujarati, that we're not offended all the time by everything.
And Parle, I did mention earlier that I am a big fan of your fashion, but that's like kind of gone down a little bit after I found out you're wearing
You don't
props,
need to keep repeating
that's okay.
That. I'm like, I think she's forgotten, but you clearly haven't.
You know, Paula, every time I'm going to watch your YouTube videos, because you always show like everything from your waist above.
Yeah.
I'm just going to think you're wearing Crocs.
I know. I might make some Garba themed ones, add a touch of Bandhani, add some mirrors to it and whatever. Yeah, why not?
But you have mentioned before that you want to do more projects related to fashion and also with mental health.
Yeah, absolutely.
But we were just saying that you were saying that, you know, you make people laugh and you make people smile, but obviously mental health is something that's quite different. So what got you interested in mental health and what are your plans to work around
this? Being someone who suffered from mental health issues in the past with such a positive outcome through like getting creative and that sort of thing. I feel like it's, you know, it's so misunderstood, and it's made out to be such a scary topic, and it's made out to be like a topic where there is no like happy ending, or there is nothing positive that can come out of it. I feel like I have a responsibility in one way to like talk about it, but also it's something that I enjoy doing, because a lot of the times you see so many, I don't want to say instant fixes, but like instant sort of steps to the right direction. So I don't particularly have like any set plans for what I want to do with mental health, but one of the things that I'm really looking forward to do doing is kind of hanging out with older people from the Gujarati community, like the elderly in nursing homes and the rest of that, and just making like very light-hearted funny videos where I'm talking to them about mental health and seeing what they know, and then kind of like untangling their views, if that makes sense. So maybe I would make a video with like an elderly lady, and kind of just speak to her and just make it very fast and choppy and that sort of thing, just to show that it doesn't actually take as long as we think to untangle the myths that there are surrounding mental health issues.
Probably, may I ask, what did you
suffer from? I suffered from anxiety that was kind of triggered by depression in, I think, 2012. And while that might come across as, oh, like, it must have been, like, really, really bad, whilst it was bad, I felt that with the right help and channeling into the right people, it was quickly diagnosed and taken care of. And because I came out of like all those issues in such a positive way, and I kind of look back upon it and see it as a blessing, I feel like others might be able to do the same thing. Just like they've related to my videos, they might be able to relate to the fact that there is light at the end of the tunnel, and going through a mental health issue can often make you someone that understands them better, and then allows you to help other people around you better. So I feel like I can only do what I'm doing with mental health because I'm someone who suffered from it before. So I see it as a blessing. Like, yeah, it was a horrible time. I mean, it was so bad that I couldn't even board like a train by myself. I used to get so scared to just go near a platform. That's how serious it was. And going from that to being someone who
and
just
traveled. How did your parents?
My parents were very supportive. I feel like they were supportive in a way that didn't actually make it out to them personally that they were supporting me. They were just there for me, just like normal parents. But I think the difficulty around that is that they never really understood that I had a mental health issue, because I never really spoke to them about it. So they never really, at the time, never really thought there was anything like actually mentally not right with me. So they just thought it was stress and university studies and the rest of that. But I think now, like, we can talk about it openly and everything's fine. And they're very sort of, in fact, they come up to me. And if they read something about it, they'll speak to me about it, which is wonderful, because there's this stereotype that, oh, like, Asian parents don't want to ever speak about mental health, or they don't think it exists. Yeah. But here where I have my parents who will approach me, talk about like the rise in depression, or they'll talk about how, like Western-based drugs are not being able to facilitate a suitable cure for depression, and why there must be something more that should be done rather than like popping a pill type thing. And these are all like really forward conversations. And it's strange because I would be having these with them in the sense that I would be starting them with them, but they're starting them with me. So it's cool. Like, I've seen a shift in them, a lot of my aunts and uncles as well. So it is possible. It's just how you serve it, I suppose.
But you said that you were diagnosed quite early and you got the right kind of help. Mm-hmm. And at the time, you were not even talking to your family about what was going on. So how did that come about, the diagnosis and the help?
Okay, so while I was going through depression, like the best way to explain it is I had like this grasp with reality, if that makes sense. So I once mm-hmm. I knew what, because I had come across what depression was before I got depressed, I knew what it was and I knew that it could exist and I knew that its symptoms would be like what they are and whatever. So I feel like because of that, I had this grasp with reality. Like I held on to reality in a strong way. So while I, you know, was down and I was unwell, I still knew about the fact that it was an ill, like I was unwell with something. Does that make sense? So
yeah,
it wasn't like, what's wrong with me? Why do I feel like this? I knew very well what was wrong with me and why I felt that way. And because I was aware and I had that kind of like grasp of reality, I was quickly able to like speak to like our university's counselor, get to the GP and explain my symptoms and the rest of that. I knew very well that depression wasn't only a mental health issue, but you would have a lot of physical ailments as well, like back pains and constantly being tired, lack of appetite. I knew all these things were because of my depression and not because of something else. So I feel like I was lucky that I came across what depression was before and I read about it, because I'm just naturally very into reading about things. So I was lucky. But a lot of people in the South Asian community aren't, and that's what's scary. And a lot of my friends didn't know how to deal with it. They didn't know what it was, as in they knew what depression was, but they didn't know how to help or how to reach out to me or how to assist me. So I had like maybe one or two friends that were not like super close, but that helped me out. But my closest friends were sadly like not, I don't want to say of no use, but they just weren't educated when it came to depression. And for maybe like 2-3 months, I did blame them. I felt so bad. I was like, why do these people not understand me? They're meant to be my friends. But then, you know, in the long run, I realized, well, how much can you blame these people if they've not really been taught about what depression is or what it can do to someone? Then how can you expect them to just know as soon as you fall in? Do you know what I mean? There wasn't enough awareness. And even though we brag here in the UK about, you know, like having the top education institutions and the rest of that, we still don't cover it in school. It's just touched upon. It's never understood as something serious. It's, of course, an invisible illness. So it's kind of like, how do you even... Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I was reading an article by this American woman who struggled with mental health all her life. Mm-hmm. She struggled with depression and anxiety, and she was diagnosed at a very young age, and her own family couldn't really understand it. And she was writing about how, and she very recently, she went through a series of groundbreaking shock therapy mm-hmm. treatments that have helped her immensely, and she's a big advocate for that. But she was talking about how the first barrier for most people struggling with mental health issues like depression is that they don't even want to get help. They don't even want to get out of bed, let alone pick up the phone and call their GP.
Yeah.
So so when you're a friend or a family member who has no idea how to reach out, the one thing you could do is make that appointment for them. Offer to make it for them. Say that you need help right now. I'm going to pick up your phone. I'm going to call your GP. I'm going to get you an appointment and you're going to talk to this therapist. Mm. So did you feel that you were lacking motivation? So you said you went to your counselor and your counselor hooked you up with your GP and then you soon got diagnosed and you got help. But do you think that maybe if one of your friends who, like you said, sadly couldn't really know, couldn't really understand what was going on, mm-hmm. do you think if one of them had just, you know, said, you know what, I'm going to do this for you, I'm going to pick up the phone and get you 100%.
Absolutely. Because you need like outside intervention, if that makes sense, to a good extent. And I did get that eventually, not from one of my close friends, but from another friend who then has become one of my closest friends now. But it's sad that I didn't get it from the people that I expected it from. Do you see what I'm saying? Like, it was just out of pure luck that one of my old friends was in town, and this person has worked for you know, mental health charities and that sort of thing. And she clearly knew what it was and was always approachable and just kept on bugging me until I really just told them what was up. And then they intervened. But they sort of, you know, really pushed themselves to find out. They didn't, they weren't egotistical about the situation, like, oh, well, I've tried to help him and he's not responded, so I have to leave it at that. They very much chased up on me and really were genuinely concerned. And another thing is, it was very invisible. I just looked like a happy university student, like, getting on. It wasn't this depression where, like, it was hugely evident, like, on my face or, like, if I was out and about. It was a very sort of unconventional in the sense that compared to what people think depression is. I mean, you can be depressed and still be functioning and happy to a good extent. It's a very complex thing. It's not always about being sad. And I really dislike how the media for a long time have used sad and depressed interchangeably. They're very different, especially in terms of a medical perspective. You can suffer from anhedonia, which is basically like you losing the interest to do what you used to love to do, and, you know, not being at one with all your hobbies and the rest of that. And I think that was a big part of what happened with me. Like, I was losing interest in just everything, basically, whether it was my studies or friends or relationship, everything. Like, nothing was interesting me anymore. I was becoming very careless, from someone who was carefree to careless. My friend picked up on that. But I was lucky to have, like, that friend who wasn't that close then to step in. But it would have obviously been nicer. But as I said, I couldn't possibly blame my friends, because they've been, you know, living in a bubble where depression has never been taught to them in the right way.
Yeah.
Or has been taught to them in a tick box way, sort of like, today, kids, we're going to learn about depression. Cool, you know it. Okay, bye. Let's move on. How much can you blame those people if they've not really been taught the complexities of what it is?
That's why we have platforms like yours through your channel. And, you know, hopefully someone who's listening to this podcast is also benefiting from this conversation.
Absolutely.
But speaking of various channels that we have, you know, the BBC Asian Network is something that we can get into right now. And that is one place that is very difficult to get your foot into. Mm-hmm. And you currently have your own show there every Sunday, which is aired every Sunday.
That's right.
So I want to know how you basically, you know, got your foot in that door. How did you get in there? How did you get your own show? Because
it's a crazy one, this one. Because, you know, I always thought to myself that, oh, if I ever make it working for an institution that I want to work at, or, you know, if I have some sort of break or a big step in the right direction of, like, my career aspirations, then I'll be able to tell this wonderfully romanticized story about how it all came together. But honestly, it's a weird one. Like, I don't feel like there was, like, this big build-up of it happening, or, like, I never really saw it coming. And you sort of dream of these things, you really do. Like, oh my god, imagine having your own radio show at a national institution as reputable as the BBC, and especially the Asian Network, somewhere that's always kind of like tried to champion what it means to be British Asian. As a slogan we have is the sound of Asian Britain. And I think what happened is I used to get invited to guest on a lot of the shows all the time, not to present, but just as a guest on the show. So I would go in on Nihal's show, and his show would be a bit more of like a debate or something serious. Or I would go on Alpa Pandya's show, who used to run the Gujarati show before I came in, and her show is a little bit more traditional. Or I would go on Noreen Khan's show for Generation YouTube. I would go onto Tommy Sandu's old breakfast show to do something, you know, fun and energetic in the morning. And I think what they quickly realized is that I was very much up for a challenge, and I was very much up for doing something versatile. But more than a comedian, I yearned and really, really wanted to be a personality that young people could relate to, that wasn't always comedy related or YouTube related. And I think they quickly picked up on my absolutely crazy, outrageous passion And outrageous because people still see it as something that's over the top. But my passion for being South Asian and British, and it was just kind of like that. It was really strange. Like, I met with one of the heads of program, and they just wanted to meet me because they wanted to know what my career plans are. So I kind of met him once and we got on really well, and he was really fascinated that actually Parle doesn't only know about like Gujarati music, but he knows very much about like the Asian music scene and how it's developed, and he can talk about it for hours and hours, and he's really passionate about like not only rising himself but seeing other people rise as well, like supporting the community and like mentoring this early on in his like budding sort of career. And that's what they recognize. Not that I was like the best broadcaster in the world or I had years and years of radio experience, because I had none of that. I just had like...
That's the thing. I was reading up on, you know, most of the names that you mentioned as the big radio names from the BBC Asian Network. Mm-hmm. I was just reading up and I saw how they had, a lot of them had spent years, you know, struggling at smaller stations before they finally got to the BBC. Mm-hmm. But the first radio show you hosted was pretty much BBC.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And they, the way they saw it is they, the Asian Network have wanted to take things to a new audience and to understand like the 21st century British Asian kind of like 16 to 35 age range audience. And they knew that making videos was not the only thing for me. They knew very much that I like to keep an eye on the community, go to community events, network with the right people, you know, gig in the States, gig in India, like do shows out there and understand that audience as well. So I think they felt that, why does it matter that he's not like the world's most experienced radio presenter, but what about all these other things? We can teach him how to do radio and he can help us.
But did you have a degree though? Did you have a degree in media?
Yes, I did a degree in broadcast media and engineering, and it's like a digital media degree. It didn't really cover radio. And the irony here is when I did the degree, I'd always be like, broadcast media, gosh, this sounds like a radio degree, but it has nothing to do with working on radio. And then I ended up working in radio. It was literally over green tea. And I was like drinking green tea. And then he goes, well, we'd like to offer you your own show. And I remember just choking, like, what, me? Like this early on? I was like, I don't even have a voice for radio, let alone a face. But they've been very supportive. And what's been really nice is they've really listened to me and kind of let me channel in my knowledge about the community. And I've been very genuine with them as well. I've been like the first to say that, hey, we need to stop doing this and stop understanding Gujarati music just as this. Like, if you're playing all these other languages and expecting people to just embrace music because music has no language, well, why is there no Gujarati music? And not only Gujarati music, but I'm like, why is there no Tamil music? I was like, where's the Telugu music? I was like, where's the music in this language? I'm like, why should our playlist, you know, be the BBC Asian Network playlist, but only be in one language? And you know what? They have listened. The song that I released, Last Navratri, was in the playlist. Rahul, who's another Gujarati artist who's British as well, his song Gemcho was in the playlist as well. That's received something like 50 million views on YouTube. And that was like in the charts as well. So I feel like there have been challenges for our community. But, you know, if you address them, then things do change. But I feel like it's not only my responsibility. And me letting other people rise should mean that they feel responsible as well. They shouldn't just feel like, okay, Parle is doing this. Great, we've got someone. They should feel that Parle is doing this and we should be too, chasing careers in journalism, in media, in anything that gives you a voice to a larger audience.
But before you got into BBC and before you started working on your YouTube channel, were you doing anything before that? Were you working in any other job?
Well, the kind of jokes and the rest of that started in when I had a small little retail job. While I was at university. So I worked in retail for 7 years, just part-time. But again, you're dealing with people all the time and you're analysing, like, your people watching to a good extent as well. And I think that's where I really found the confidence in my funny bone, because I used to just say things and my colleagues would always be like, you know, you need your own show. You just need to broadcast what you're saying to the world. So I quickly started broadcasting on Snapchat, like just stories, and all my friends would be like, please stop doing this on Snapchat because the story's gone. They're like, can't you do it on Instagram where it stays? So I started doing clips and bits and pieces on Instagram, and then and then I was like, well, I've always wanted to do YouTube. And I was doing stuff on YouTube before as well. I did like a small little series with a friend of mine on YouTube before. But the nature of YouTube is that viral content receives an audience faster. So to build an audience, you start with like viral content, which gets you recognized, and then you can build an audience. But my first sort of thing was music related, actually. I made like this 20-minute mix of some Gujarati songs in like a new sort of loungish sort of way that was really popular, and that's sort of it. I also worked corporate as well for a while, for about a year, for a health and well-being company. Okay. Where I was like designing some digital bits and pieces, like tutorials on how to use an app. And I remember one day coming into my office and everyone smiling at me like ear to ear, and I'm like, oh my god, do they know about my dirty internet secret? And then my CEO, who was actually my uncle, he like invited everyone into his office, and then he was just like, oh my gosh, like, we've seen your videos, you're absolutely hilarious, we want to support this as well. Which I didn't even know how to react to. I was like, am I in trouble like for doing this? Like, is this wrong or right? And whatever. Because, you know, in the beginning, the first few videos, some people were outraged, but that kind of egged me on to do more. So, yeah.
But Parley, we had the same problem as well. When we released our first few episodes, I don't know if you've had a chance to, please don't do that.
You're quite good.
But like when we started our first season, our first few episodes, we jumped into really delicate topics like arranged marriage, love marriage and education. And we had the same problem. And there were times where I spoke to Ankita and I said, I don't know if we should continue doing this because it doesn't seem to be sitting well with a lot of people. But then we realized that the fact that people have a problem with it means that we're probably doing something right.
Absolutely. Probably thinking, but the least we can do is make them think about it and get a reaction.
Yeah, raise the profile of the problem. Absolutely. Make it aware that it is a problem. It's still very much real and the rest of that. So, yeah. Definitely nothing wrong with that.
So to any of the youngsters who might be listening right now, Parley, and if there's a youngster who would like to get into radio or pursue a degree in media and journalism, would you still recommend that they go ahead and get that degree? Or would you advise another route to land this kind of a job in?
I think now, like, my inner, oh my God, Parley will soon be a Gujarati dad or a Gujarati parent one day too, let's hope, if I find Mrs. Patel. Who knows? But what I mean to say by that is I still very much think like my parents to, I would say, like a 20% degree type thing, like in the sense that you have to be really clever in this world of like media, and you really have to think of clever ways of how you're going to make it work. And getting a degree, getting work in the media might not mean that you need to study it at university. It might mean that you need to study something else, you need to earn some money, then invest that money into buying equipment, and then with that equipment, like, doing a lot of trial and error sort of things, kind of like having a day hustle, and then kind of like working weekends, doing a whole bunch of other things until you meet the right person that will offer you a job. That might be a better approach than doing something like media and then traditionally going out and looking for a job. Saying that, to get experience in the media industry is not as difficult as people think, but you have to make your own sacrifices. So that might mean working unpaid. It might mean, you know, working with 5 or 6 different companies until you've really had a good time. You really have to want it to work in the media. And even with me, in my first year whilst doing stuff with Planet Parley, even up to the second year, I was taking so much unpaid work, and people were like, oh my god, like, how do you survive, how do you manage? And I'm like, well, it's working, and you have to think like a business person, and you have to think like, okay, if I'm putting this many hours into this, what am I getting in return? Or, okay, I need this from someone, but I don't have a cash payment available to them, but what can I trade with them? So you have to actually think like a hustler. Mm. I made a funny video about this as well. You have to actually hustle your way through it. And then after a while...
But you're Gujarati. Gujaratis know how to...
This is what I mean. This is what I mean. This is what I was saying. Like, you have to... I had to think like my Gujarati parents. But then I also got to a stage where I'm like, okay, I have now worked with BBC World. I've worked with CBBC. I'm working at the Asian Network. I've traveled to do shows around the world where I've earned money. You draw a line and you begin to tell yourself that, okay, now I should be earning at least this much. And a lot of the times that means you might even turn the dream gig down because you're not earning. But until you don't do that, you can't turn working in the media in the way that I do sustainable. You can't turn it into something where you're like, this is my job. Until then, you have to tell yourself that this is a job that I'm trying to pursue. This is a lifestyle that I'm trying to pursue. And another thing is, chase the art and not the lifestyle. There's so many young people I meet that are like, I want to be a YouTuber. And I'm like, oh, okay. I was like, do you have a phone? And they're like, yeah, I have the latest iPhone. And I'm like, well, why aren't you making videos? Or I'll meet someone and they'll be like, I want to be a music producer. Mm. And I'm like, well, do you make music? And they're like, no. And I'm like, well, what's stopping you? And they're like, oh, I'm just not really bothered. So it's kind of like, well, anything that you want to do, start with it, whatever it is. Like, even when I started designing costumes, I said to myself, I want to make costumes. Not costumes, sorry, I hate that word. I want to make outfits. So I thought, well, where am I going to learn? So I spoke to my mum. She gave me some, like, templates on, like, how to cut a kedu. And then from then, in my free time, when I want to relax, that's exactly what I do. I research on, you know, fabric and how to go about things and like learning the skills. And another big problem is, and I think this is a big thing in the West more than India, and that is what you just said about qualification. Your mum is probably a master chef. Do we agree that our mothers are master chefs?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, all mothers are master chefs.
Yeah, exactly. But where did they go to study? Like, where? What qualification do they have that makes them amazing cooks in the kitchen? They've learned in such a classical and innate, natural way where a recipe's been passed down, or they've shadowed someone and, you know, they've experimented themselves and the rest of that. They don't have a bit of paper in their sitting room saying that, you know, I have a first class degree in how to be a mum, or I have a first class degree in how to cook a wonderful three course Gujarati dinner or whatever. But they can still do that. So it's kind of like that. The world as we know it is changing very quickly, in the sense that we are now being taken for, you know, what people can actually see us do. And it's that those achievements don't always come in the form of qualifications or bits of paper. They might come via portfolios or where you've worked for and the rest of that. So I think that's a really important thing as well that I say to a lot of young people. I'm like, go out there and do work experience. I've been doing like short films and shadowing people and been making cups of tea for like people like ever since I was 14. That's how early I started. I used to make films on my digital camera. I'm talking like not even HD. This was before HD. And I remember that each shot could only be 5 minutes long. That's the longest the camera would record. So I'd have to record 5 minutes of something and then I would have to cut the shot. And then I used to go into classrooms during lunchtime, and I used to have like private screenings and things like that with my friends. That's literally how I got started in content creation. But it was that sort of zest, that obsession of creating, not the obsession of being part of the industry, but I just wanted to create and make stories and make content and make things people could see.
Yeah, because probably I was talking to a friend the other day and I was talking about how, like, for example, like medical studies, yeah, of course they're difficult, but the thing with studying medicine or maybe any other degree as well, I would assume, is that the work is prescribed to you. So you're given like a syllabus, you learn it and then you regurgitate it or whatever. But when it comes to something creative, for example, YouTube or anything that you do, even stuff like Ankita and I do, like when we're creating scripts,
no,
it's not prescribed. It's all stuff that we have to be out on the search
totally.
For. And I think people fail to understand that, because a lot of kids are thinking, yeah, it's so easy to get into YouTube, it's so easy to become famous online. But the truth is that it isn't, because the work isn't prescribed. So you have to actually put
Absolutely.
Yourself out there. And that's not said
and
enough.
Like this whole internet fame thing as well, like, you can build an audience of the millions, but that you then have to ask yourself that, have you built like an audience of millions, or have you built like a loyal sort of base of people that will really listen to you when you need them? Now, I have friends that have like a jumbo followings on Twitter and things like that. And when they tweet something that they really meaningfully need help with, they get such a like disheartening response. And they always say that, It's not because what they've said isn't like meaningful, but it's because they've built an audience that doesn't always like care about those things, if you know what I mean. Like people always tell me, like, why don't you just make a video a week? And I'm like, I could do that. I could make loads and loads of videos really, really quickly and explode. But to me, growing horizontally is the same as growing vertically as well. Like I've kind of done a lot of different things rather than just concentrate on one thing. And as I said, like dynamism is like very important to me. So whether that's my music, whether that's comedy, whether it's radio, whether it's other projects that I've got coming up, whether it's fashion, it's meant that I'm building an audience that appreciates a variety of the things I do rather than just one of the things. And that's, I've seen genuine responses from people that have been really like interested in, I don't know, the dance stuff that I'm doing, or the fashion stuff that I'm doing, or the mental health things that I'm doing. And that's been very rewarding. It's not as if I've just built an audience that just want to see funny videos all day, even though a big majority want that. But it's been nice to see that people have supported my other endeavors too.
And Paula, you have created and produced your own music video recently. And what kind of response were you expecting from that? And what kind of message were you hoping to put out there? Was it solely based upon the idea that you want to promote more Gujarati music and get more kids in our generation to get involved
with
contemporary music?
Firstly, I think that music is such a wonderful thing, because you can enjoy it even if you don't know the language it's in or the style. Like if a rhythm hits you, then it hits you and you're happy to go with it. But I just wanted to break up that huge monotony that's in Gujarati music. And I felt that, why have people sort of shied away from trying this? Like, is it because they don't know much about the language? Is it because they're scared? Is it because the beats don't match or themes don't match? And we made the song and it was enjoyed well. And, you know, these are independent releases. I've purposely kind of made them like free and like anyone can access them and contribute towards buying them if they want to pay. But otherwise, you know, they're free for all type thing. Not only to show people that it is possible, but because it's music that represents who I truly am. It's music that is so forward, yet so traditional as well. Like, it's the style of the music is so not Gujarati, especially with Zatsay, our latest release. But lyrically and tonally, it's still very Gujarati. So even like how we styled ourselves for the music video and what we were doing, it really represents who we are. Like, we were doing... there's a lot of street garba where we're out on the streets, because that's literally how I began practicing garba when we didn't have studio space and we didn't have enough money to hire studios. We would actually just find a place out on the streets that was open, or a public playground, and we would practice there until we became the troupe that we are. So a big part of it represents my narrative, and there's like this weird feeling that, oh, if you're into traditional Gujarati music, that means you probably don't hit the clubs. I am the biggest party animal in the world. I'm always in the clubs. I'm always partying as well. So I needed to make sure that that gets communicated as well, that actually you can be both, you can balance both out as well. And also, I wanted to remind people that not all Gujarati music is devotional. There's this big sort of thing that if it's a Gujarati song, that means it's going to be devotional. But it's kind of like... Gujarati music has a huge history of non-devotional music as well. And often Bollywood take these songs and turn them into super hits like Nagada Sang Dhol, Dholitaro Dhol with the intro as well. And so it's so possible to sort of create these songs that are just universal. They're not down to one particular deity or religion or the rest of that, but they're kind of open to all. I mean, we did have some outrage and backlash from people saying that we're ruining Gujarati culture because we're taking a religious song or whatever, but Zartzeya had nothing, like zero relation to religion. Like, that's one thing. If I ever cover something, I'm very sensitive about it. Even when I'm teaching dance, how we choreograph Mataji Garba compared to Lok Geet Garba, as in folk Garba, is very different. Like the style, posture, bending, mannerism. While like Lok Geet might be very like cheeky and have like an element of sensuality, Mataji Garba would never have that. So I've had to do a lot of my own research around the music and dance to differentiate different styles and the rest of that.
Well, speaking of Garba, Parle, we know that it's Navratri, Navratri this week. So what are your plans?
So Chaitra Navratri is much more devotional, you could say, than Sharad Navratri, the main Navratri that happens. And the main reason behind this is because of the weather out in India. So Sharad Navratri, which happens like September, October time, it's more popular because it's easier to dance in the weather, whereas this one, it's very warm. However, here in the UK, where it's just snowed, it's still the perfect opportunity to kind of get in your brightly coloured Garba clothes, meet up with friends, have kind of like a spiritual detox from, you know, from just life in general. And just, it feels like normal Navratri, to be honest. The only difference is that during this Navratri, only the super crazy Garba fanatics like myself who love Garba day to day come along. A lot of people don't even know that there's actually four Navratris that happen in Hinduism. And that Chaitra and Sharad...
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah,
I
no, there's just, four, yeah, I didn't know there's that four Navratris, but the other two are much, much smaller. It's Chaitra Navratri and Sharad Navratri, the two that are two of the big, big ones type thing. So yeah, just meeting up with friends. I'm doing Garba throughout the whole year. So when people say things like, oh, do you miss Garba? I'm like, no, never. I never miss it because I'm connected to it throughout the whole year. I'm choreographing the whole year. I'm performing it the whole year. I'm writing Gujarati songs the whole year. So for me, it's no longer this seasonal thing, like part-time Gujarati type thing. And at the same time, I'm still very British. Like people, some of my Gujarati friends are like outraged when I'm like, oh no, I don't want masala chai. I just want a cup of Earl Grey. And they're like, what? You don't drink masala chai every day? And I'm like, no. And more than masala chai, coffee is more dear to me. I love coffee, especially South Indian filter coffee. I have traveled out to the South. And I'm a big lover of
Meenal,
kapi.
Have you tried that ever?
Yeah, of course.
South Indian filter coffee.
It gives you such a buzz though. Like, oh my God, I'm like so hyper. It's like really strong. I find it strong and sugary, but I love it.
No, you mentioned it right now and I'm already like...
I know. Tell
so
me about
worked
it.
Up
Tell me
by
about it.
It.
Yeah. Well, Pali, Navratri is a celebration about, you know, we celebrate female goddesses and I'm sure you've heard this before as well, but for a religion that celebrates and we worship and that worships female goddesses. There's a lot of problems around feminism in India. So I don't know your views about feminism. Maybe you can tell us on the show today, but
A total feminist. And it took me a long time to admit or use the word feminist. And that's purely because being a male and having like this man ego drilled into your head that femme stands for female, but feminism is just being a humanist, you could say. We've had to use
But do your religious views in any way, because obviously
I'm hugely more than religion, I'm very spiritual, so like I've been brought up that way as well, sort of to like take on from as many philosophies around you to shape you to be like a universally accepting sort of person. And like, I think I think one of the biggest problems is, especially because of social media, everyone makes noise about what needs to be done. But I think now the world knows what needs to be done and we just need to get on with it. I'm very practical. If we need to cut the grass, there's no point me going, more needs to be done about the length of the grass in the garden. Go out there and just begin cutting it. It starts right now, straight away, instantly. And I'm looking for the right sort of projects where I can contribute as like a public figure that are aimed towards the well-being of women, especially when it comes to not only mental health, but physical health as well. So I have been looking into some interesting things out in India. And it's just a case of finding the right one and helping in the right way. And not like a one-time thing, but something that I can continue to do, if that makes sense.
I just want to talk about women in media for a bit because of your influence, and also because I feel that at least on air, be it on TV or the radio, it's more common to see women, because I was reading a statistic recently that stated that people tend to pay more attention when they hear a female voice somewhere, or they see a female face. But I'm interested in the behind the scenes of media companies and shows. Like, there are immense opportunities in sound engineering and software engineering, production management, you name it. But are enough women filling these roles in your experience working behind the scenes?
Oh, absolutely. Some of my best producers at the BBC have been females. My first ever radio show, when I broadcast it, was produced all by females. And then for a long time, I was working with just a female. So in my experience, in that sense...
That is so refreshing to hear.
It's been all females. I will say, I will agree with you in saying that females are often... they're kind of...
maybe?
No. As you said earlier, the response rate is better for females.
Right.
And I feel on YouTube, that's particularly the case because of the dynamic of YouTube's audience. A lot of YouTube audience is made up of young females. And that often means they connect to females better than they would connect to a male. So I feel like there's been... like that advantage, but then there's a whole bunch of other advantages that come along with being a female whilst making videos on the internet. So it kind of weighs up. I don't want to like be like, oh, they've had it easier, because obviously they've not. I've had certain benefits that have helped me, like the fact that there wasn't very many other Gujaratis doing what I was doing. So that's been my blessing, but at the same time, it's been kind of lonely working in the world of Gujarati YouTube, because not very many other YouTubers have done what I am trying to do, or they've not really embraced their Gujarati-ness in a way that I have. So, I suppose there's benefits, advantages and disadvantages for both.
And Polly, do you have any plans of getting into television?
That's the dream. That's absolutely where I'd love to work. Yeah. So working as a writer... for television. And I feel like, you know, when you work in the media, you kind of feel under pressure that has to be next. Like, okay, you've been doing bits and pieces for television already. CBBC is like one of the biggest children's television channels here in the UK, and you feel to yourself that, okay, I'm doing radio, I've done bits of television, I'm doing YouTube, but next for me it has to be TV. And you kind of look for opportunities and work hard to try and find opportunities. But then, like, a big part of me has like sort of realized that, hold on a minute, your whole ethos has been to create your own opportunities if there aren't opportunities available for you. Like, there wasn't opportunities to do what I wanted to do via YouTube on TV, so that's why I started YouTubing. So it kind of reminds you that, hey, if there isn't an opportunity, make one. If there's no door to knock on one, build your own door and break that own door down, type thing. So yeah, television would be the dream, but I think it's much more the dream because it kind of comes across as the next big thing. But I'm not going to hold my breath to that, and I'm very thrilled and humbled by the support I've had as a digital content creator. The fact it's let me travel, the fact that it's let me connect to people. That's already been amazing. And even though having a one-man team that films, edits, scripts, writes, you know, conceptualizes, edits, uploads, all of that has been just me for Planet Parlay, it's extremely rewarding to have it just that way for now anyway.
Well, this has been wonderful, Parle, and I didn't even realize that we've been recording for close to an hour and a half now.
I know, I told you, I'm a chatterbox.
You've been so kind.
I told you.
thank you so much for answering all of our questions so patiently.
That's okay, anytime. I'm so glad that we finally had this conversation, and I'm sure we'll have plenty more in the future.
Hopefully,
I'm really proud of what you two awesome ladies are doing. I can't wait to share this on my social media, because people don't often get a chance to just listen to me ramble on unplugged like this. I'm usually interviewing someone else. So this has been really nice.
Thank you, Polly. And if our listeners want to get in touch, how can they do that?
Super easy. Just get in touch via email. It's planetparlay@gmail.com or parlay@bbc.co.uk, or just find something of mine on social media under the handle @planetparlay. So yeah.
Great. Great, Parlay. Thank you so much for coming on the show today. We had a great
thank
time.
Thank you. Thank you.
And thank you, dear listeners, as always, for joining us this week as well. Don't forget to check out Parlay on YouTube, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, wherever you have a social media account, you will be able to find him. And you should also be tuning into his radio show every Sunday if you're listening from the UK.
We're very grateful for the reviews that you've been leaving us on iTunes. And if you haven't done that already, don't forget to drop us a review, because this will help us reach a lot more people. You can also find us on social media on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And if you have any questions, you can drop us an email to mail@desioutsiders.com. So until next week, I'm Meenal.
And I'm Ankita.
And we're the Desi Outsiders.